I think it's more tragic because if it's all just inevitable, then that means that the characters had no hope. They never had hope because they're all just like hopeless. They're all like pawns in this horrible, hopeless machine.
Hey guys, welcome back to Spooky Tuesday, a weekly podcast where we're breaking down all of our favorite slashers, thrillers, monster movies, and black comedies on the new scariest day of the week. I'm Sydney Thompson.
I'm Monica Height.
And I'm Chelsea Duff.
And today we're going to be traumatized. Are you excited,
literally?
Are you excited to see some of the most, or talk about some of the most disturbing images that have been put onto the screen? I think they're up there. I mean, there's snuff films and other things like that. There's also like Apocalypse Now and that other one, like I Spit on Your Grave. I heard that those are worse, but this one's pretty fucking bad. And I love every second of it. This week we are doing 2018's Hereditary by the amazing Ari Aster, his debut film. And here's a little IMDb logline for you. A grieving family is haunted by tragic and disturbing occurrences. I'm trying to talk happy because the movie is sad and depressing and horrifying.
If we bring the happy energy, then nobody will be so sad after listening to this episode, right?
No, no, that's how it works. So sad. I have not seen this, or had not seen this movie, since I saw it in theaters like opening weekend. And when I saw it in theaters opening weekend, it was approximately 3 weeks after my mom had died. So it hit in a very, very interesting way. And it was very fun to watch this. I know fun is a weird word for it, but I was like fascinated. It was fun to watch it and not just be like being slapped around the whole time, having an emotional roller coaster wild ride. So you could really see what's going on, because there's so much going on in this movie. So much.
There's what so is, much
have
going
y'all
on.
Have you seen it before? Sydney, I know you've seen it before.
So I first saw this movie in 2021. I saw it at my house. I saw it after cleaning my house and finding some club attending supplements, and was like, huh, I wonder if these are still good. So I tested it out and then was like, let's watch Hereditary. And
science, am I right?
I am a I'm a woman in STEM, okay?
She's a woman in STEM, baby.
When you first told me that, I was like, what in the ever-loving fuck? Like, how did you mentally survive? Like, do you think that your mental health took a knock after that day?
Okay, the thing with this movie is that it lingers, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
what?
This movie,
Does it stick with you? Are there disturbing images and concepts in here? Crazy.
Yeah, this movie loves to linger, which, like, who doesn't, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I like didn't think about it at first because I was like, la 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 la, oh, that's fucked up, la 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 la, what is going on, la 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 la, there's a lot of bugs in this movie. And then afterwards,
yeah, there are a lot of bugs.
I was like, oh my god, and it like stuck with me for days afterwards. And then this time it was like watching a brand new movie. I was like, oh, I remember that. But oh my God, I did not notice that.
And yes.
I mean, even if you watch it the first time, there's just like a bunch of stuff that you wouldn't or couldn't notice because there's so much shit in this movie. So much shit.
So much.
Yeah,
every second there's a fucking Easter egg almost. Like, he's a brilliant man, Ari, but he needs to take a deep breath. Jesus Christ, sir. How does your brain work on this level?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting part of the movie, because I had seen it before and I didn't really feel like I got it last time. And I don't really know that I like got it this time either necessarily, but I think it's the kind of thing where you're not supposed to fully get it. You're just experiencing it. But there is so much throughout the film, and they're like IMDb trivia, there are quotes from Ari Aster where he's talking about how like everything in the beginning ties back to something in the very end. And like Toni Collette said she was so impressed that like Ari Aster had this whole film basically like shot and edited in his head 2 years before they ever started filming. Like he had this whole thing down to a well-oiled machine. And it's interesting because like you're saying there are so many things you didn't notice the first time. And it's not because the camera doesn't linger on them and show them to you specifically, but it's because you can't appreciate what you're seeing and like file it away as information relevant to other things until you have the full picture. And so it's so strange to go back and rewatch it and be like, okay, so this symbol is here. Like, what does that mean? Like, is some, like, how are, what's going on? Who's involved? Theories. Are things being planned? What's the deal?
You're, cause you can't possibly, I mean, maybe if you like are like stone fucking cold and like really analytical. I was like reeling during this movie when I saw it the first time, because there are some gut fucking punches. There are some horrifying images that take you a second to get over. And then you have to be looking at the tiny little light and this and the, and that, and all these other little things that are going on. It's hard when you're so fucking freaked out. It's not like the scariest movie I've ever seen, but it's just like so deeply unsettling to the, just like the pulsing, just that, the pulsing throughout the film. You hear that where it sounds like there's a club in the room next door. That's like half the film. That sound is just in the background. The unts, 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 unts. Adam had it like stuck in his head after the movie. Like he couldn't stop hearing that sound. Like it's a fucking, it'll sink its teeth into you, this movie. Oh, I love it.
I texted y'all about it yesterday. I watched this movie and then I was on YouTube and I found a 4.5 hour complete guide, everything explained by Novum, N-O-V-U-N on YouTube. And I mean, it's double the length of the movie because this is actually it's double and some, but there's just so much stuff. And this thing literally pointed out shit that even though like I wouldn't have even thought of, there's color association and there is like more people in this weird cult that you wouldn't think are in this cult, but like there's like basically everybody's in this town is in this one cult. Like it's insane. There's writing on the walls. There's that nobody.
I know what some of those words mean because somebody looked it up for me. Like there's so much that goes into it. But I mean, yeah, I guess we should like dive in from the beginning because every part is so important. It starts out with we have Annie, Toni Collette, who is such a fucking tour de force. And I want to start off by saying that she is so good at being the mom of a spooky child. That's kind of like her MO. We saw it in, I always am going to forget, Sixth Sense. There we go. What did I think it was called the other day? Dead People or something like that. I couldn't remember the name of that movie.
Classic, Monica.
Toni Collette is the mom in that film as well. And now we got Toni Collette here, who's the mother of Charlie, played by Millie Shapiro, who I love. I follow her on Instagram. She's awesome. And also Peter, played by Alex Wolff of the Naked Brothers Band fame.
Icon, icon, icon. And he's so good in this movie, too.
He is. I love him and his distinctive mole. Oh, I love that for him.
He got nominated for an MTV Movie Award, so you know it's real.
For Best Mole?
But he is...
For Best Mole, yeah.
Yes!
And the husband is Steve, played by Gabriel Byrne. That's a hard word to say. The Y in there is very confusing. And Adam recognized him for many, many roles. I did not recognize him at all, but he's also had an illustrious career. But yeah, it starts out immediately. Grandma is dead.
Yeah, we get an obit, which the obit has so much information in it.
Oh shit! I didn't reread it at the end.
Oh, don't
of the
worry.
Movie.
I took a picture.
Spill,
I took a couple pictures of this of the screen during this movie because I was like, I don't have time to write this down, but I need to capture this right now. So I'll read it for you. It says, Ellen Taper Lee, 78, passed away after a prolonged illness at her daughter Annie's house on April 3rd, 2018. Beloved wife of the late Martin Lee, RIP. Devoted mother of Annie Lee Graham and the late Charles Lee, RIP. Cherished grandmother of Peter Graham and Charlie Graham. She is also survived by her son-in-law, Dr. Stephen Graham. She will be missed. Reposing at Kingstone Funeral Home, Friday 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. Funeral service to be held on Saturday 10 a.m. Burial will take place. I don't know how to say that fucking word. Whatever. It takes place at Spring Blossom Cemetery. So yeah, they're just like, here's the info. Lots of the family members are already dead. Now she's dead too. And also the little tidbit about Steve being a doctor actually is super interesting because
yes, that makes
I have
a lot
things
more
to say
sense.
About that.
That makes a lot more sense knowing that now. Oh man. Yeah, I mean, and it starts out almost immediately with what happens right at the very beginning. I just remember the funeral as the first thing.
We see Peter's room.
Oh, yes. The miniatures. Oh, my God. I love miniatures. There's a lot of movies that are doing this shit now, but this is the best one.
They all copied really CSI. Good. All of them. Every single
okay,
one of them.
Fair, fair.
Copied.
Also talk. Yeah. Jigsaw. What was first? CSI or Jigsaw?
That's a good question. Miniatures, killer, but CSI. I think CSI, but I could be wrong.
Jigsaw got it going, maybe. Maybe it was CSI, and then it led to this day. So it's very beautiful. But that shot is so fucking seamless. Like, the cinematography in this movie is so fucking good. Like, the zooming in on the house and zooms in on Peter's room, and it's literally like perfect. Like, he's there, you're in the room. It's so perfect. It's so genius.
Oh, you know what? I think Saw might have come before CSI.
Ooh,
it's
interesting,
all Jigsaw. It's all
Saw.
Jigsaw.
This is a Saw episode now. It inspired CSI. It inspired Criminal Minds. We're a Saw girlies now. I don't know if you guys knew that. If you haven't listened to that episode already.
We are.
No, we're very clearly
Saw for life.
Saw
we're Saw girlies now.
Saw for life. Saw for life. But yeah, I mean, you enter into this family in the middle of tragedy. Like, they're all waking up on the morning of the funeral. They're mm-hmm. all running a little bit late. And like, even from moment one, there's little fucking details. Some of them you'd never know because they don't make them very explicit. Like, for example, we meet Peter. He's getting up late, whatever. We meet Charlie. She is sleeping in the very, very, very cool treehouse that they have. Very cool, very, very spooky. And she immediately, when her dad comes to wake her up, she puts a lid on the box next to her. If you notice that, do you want to know why?
Okay.
Why?
Apparently, there's like three other decapitated animal heads in there.
Oh, good. Great.
Yep. So that's a fun little tidbit. That's why she was so nervous about that. Because, you know, she needs the decapitated heads for her weird, creepy mannequin doll
art. Projects. Great.
Yeah, I really love her art style. It's a family of artists, honestly. Mommy Annie does her miniatures. Baby Charlie does her taxidermy
dolls?
Adjacent sort of hodgepodge doll making. Sydney recently sent me a very exciting shop on Etsy that sells taxidermy animal heads put onto
dolls' bodies,
fancy doll bodies. So it's actually very
I want
similar
one
to this.
So bad too.
I Aww. Yeah, no, you really need one, and I want to buy you one, but they're so fucking
they're so
expensive,
expensive
and they sell out so quickly.
I'm saving up
they
for one.
Well, good for that artist. We love to support artists.
Dear listener, if you would like to buy me a creepy doll, I would love that. Just please don't be haunted. Thank you.
Well, I mean, I don't think you could ask for a creepy doll and then also ask her to not be haunted. It's like, do you want the creepy doll or not?
Exactly. Seriously.
You gotta accept the risk.
Truly. But I just love the funeral scene. I love all of Toni Collette's monologues in this movie because there are quite a few of them and they all bang. You learn so much about Queen Lee in her and their Annie and hers fraught relationship in this eulogy, because it is a weird fucking eulogy. She's like, hey, all you people, I don't know who any of you are. That's weird. I feel uncomfortable even speaking about my mom because she's so secretive. This feels like a betrayal. Like, it's just, there's so, so much. And you start getting the signs even here, because Annie is wearing a necklace at the funeral that her mother gave her, which is that symbol that's recurrent throughout the rest of the film. You very soon afterwards see Queen Lee's body, and she has the exact same necklace on. And yeah, it's a great introduction to how there's some fucked shit going on in this family, at least on an interpersonal level, but boy, does it go deeper.
Honestly, some fucked shit is a great way to explain this movie.
Oh, yeah. Truly. But I mean, it's the set pieces in those first few scenes are just so interesting, because like, to start with the vision of the treehouse outside of the window already tells you what one of the central locations is going to be, but it gives you like this weird distance from it. It's like very much outside looking in. You have like the zoom out of that, and there's like a fly that goes by. So there's one of the bugs that Sydney mentioned, and like another little ominous thing. You get the miniatures in Toni Collette's studio, and like the zoom in on Peter's room and the way it like becomes Peter's room as it gets closer. Like, it's not like a cut from the miniature to the real thing.
No,
it becomes the real thing. Yes, and like this shift slightly of perspective to reveal like additional details that make it more clearly like a real lived in room, like little clothing items on the floor that you couldn't see before, the way the dad comes in. But just like this, the speech at the funeral, and then the moment where Charlie is like eating her chocolate bar and they're like, no nuts in that, right? We don't have your EpiPen, is just like, right off the bat, they're just like, okay, here's like our major things we need you to not even know, not even appreciate, but we just need you to not even realize that we are telling you things right off the bat.
Well, like every moment is important. Like when Charlie goes up to the casket to say goodbye to her grandma, then she looks back and she sees that weird fucking guy staring at her.
And that lady who like wipes something on the lips of the grandma.
Yeah, that guy, I don't know if I should say the thing that he is yet. Later on, he's fully naked and staring at you through a doorway. It's that guy.
He is.
It's that fucking
with the
guy.
Same, with nothing on but a smile, baby.
Oh, yeah. Oh, we get full dick in this movie. That's another.
Well, you're never fully
thank you, Ari.
A smile.
So true. So true. Also, I feel like Smile, the movie, took a lot of the like creepy smile shit from this. That is pretty clear. Because I mean, that's one of the most haunting parts. We're not there yet, but that first smile we get from this creepy man starts it off. Yeah, and it's just immediately goes to the end of the funeral. They go back home, and here's a moment that I missed when I first watched this movie. There are actually two things. One is super fucking obvious. The other one is like, you would never notice unless y'all did too. I had to read it in the comments of an article that I read about this movie. But one, I totally missed that they had a dog when they come home and they say hi to the dog. So like later on in the dog's like never in the movie, except like later on he's in like in a very important scene. And I was like, what does the dog symbolize? Why is the dog here? It is their dog. They just have a dog. So sometimes you can overdo it too with the analysis.
He pops up like a couple times throughout, but yeah, he's a very subtle touch.
I missed him every single time, literally every single time. And I was watching this movie so closely, so I don't know how. But the other moment that happens just before the dog comes into the picture, they show the house empty for a few seconds before the family opens the door. And you hear like pitter patter, pitter patter, slam. And that's like you barely can hear it, but there's someone in the house already. There's already the cult members in the house doing some fuck shit upstairs in the home. Again, more fuck shit. But yeah, they get home and they're all just like, should I be more sad? Are you sad? How are you feeling? Because I'm not feeling that sad.
Do you want to cry? I'm not sure I can cry, so I'm trying to get you to cry instead. Will you cry? Do you feel like
you
want to cry?
Like, maybe one of us
You've never cried before, but, like, do you think you could now? Maybe? You didn't even born, but, like, would you like to cry?
That was so weird when she's like, yeah, Charlie, do you want to cry for the very first time in your life? That's so scary, though. A baby that is born and doesn't cry, like, at all. Like, ooh, ominous. Very good at holding her tongue from the very beginning.
From the first moment. Yeah.
Charlie Slay.
Charlie Slay. Oh, there's so many. Like, how early do we start talking about everything? Can we just do it now? I don't know how else to, like, I'll remember everything otherwise.
Yeah, I think we do a little spoiler warning. So that's your spoiler warning, because I just said the words. I'll say them one more time just in case you need them. Spoiler warning. There's really no way to talk about this movie without, I mean, we already talked about the cultists. You know what I mean?
Without analyzing it every minute of the way.
Yeah.
So something that you find out pretty soon after the beginning of this movie, through a really cool scene where Toni Collette goes to a grief group. And she sort of gives you, like, more of a picture of how the family works and how the mom, how Annie and Queen Lee, like, functioned together. Because it's super fucked up. Something that, like, is interesting. Queen Lee's husband, so Annie's father, died of starvation. He starved himself, which is so fucking horrifying. I don't know how that plays into the greater narrative, but I'm sure there's something that I just didn't read about how that plays into the whole cult thing, because it feels like it would. But Charles, Annie's brother, committed suicide, and he apparently blamed his mom in the suicide note and said that she was trying to put someone in him. And Annie not writes this off, but, like, as any person would assume, you know, puts this into, like, sort of the scope of mental illness. So there's, like, two reads on this movie. People, like, see this. You can watch it for the supernatural parts of it, which obviously are the main parts of it. But also there's, like, a talk about, like, how mental illness is hereditary in family. So that's sort of, like, the subtext behind it too. And that's, like, what happens later on with the father, Steve, like, thinking that he can boil this all down to Annie having an episode, as it's clear that people in her family have had issues and struggles with mental health. And so it's really, really interesting to be able to look at it from two sides, because obviously it literally is a cult, but you can explain away many of these things by, like, the grandma's dementia or Charles's schizophrenia is what they called it. Tony or Annie's sleepwalking. She's sleepwalking later in the movie, you know, but it's all more than that. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I always have a hard time when scary movies are like, is it mental illness or is it a paranormal phenomenon? Thank you for bringing a little lightness, because it does fuck me up. But it is just, it's really tough and hard to reckon with as subject matter, as something as you're trying to, like, dissect the film itself.
Yeah.
But they're laying the groundwork both for, like, you don't know what's real. You don't know what the characters think is real. You don't know what they're explaining away as something else that makes more sense to them. You don't know if no one was ever sick in the first place, and there are more, like, culty things going on than we realize at first. It is just absolutely a very tricky, strange little mess. But yeah, that's part of why I think the dad being a doctor is so interesting also. Yeah. Because when he has that moment where he's emailing a colleague, like it's the same like email address, not home base, I don't know, domain that he's emailing to and emailing from. And my whole thing when I was watching this movie, I was like, has nobody heard of going to therapy or sending your child to therapy or anything? And then I was also like, but they have meds. They're all popping pills. So like, where are they getting these meds? But if the dad is a doctor, he certainly can write prescriptions.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's such a mess. It's such a strange... Ugh, it's so complicated to get into, because also then it's like, well, she says she never wanted to have kids, and you can imagine that like it's both her familial trauma that's playing into that, and also like you're saying, like she's concerned maybe about like what's in her genes, what is she gonna pass on, what would she be giving to her kids. She has all these horrible experiences. Oh my god, it's just, that's all I have to say.
It's just like this movie really makes you think about so many things that are so deeply uncomfortable to grapple with. And this family has just so much baggage on so many levels. And, you know, it's relatable because like people do have this level of, again, fuck shit happening in their family. And I don't know. I thought it was really interesting too, like, her talking about like how she was estranged from her mom and then she was sucked back in, how she tried to protect her son Peter from her mother, but then like she, you know, reneged on that, Charlie. I guess, with Charlie. Also didn't realize this at all, named Charlie after the brother Charles.
Uh-huh.
And she was, I mean, we got to talk about it throughout, she was trying to get Payman into Charles, obviously. He wasn't, you know.
Or
maybe he was also schizophrenic, but he also really was, his mommy really was trying to put a demon into his body, you know.
We saw his little welcome mat with all the little symbols embroidered into it. We know there was intention there, even if it wasn't being pulled off.
Yeah. And that's something that I thought was really, really interesting. It's hard. We just have to talk about it now. With Charlie herself, I think most people assume this, but maybe not. But like, Charlie and Payman are the same. Like, she came out with Payman in her. So no. Maybe she has her own.
No. In my 4.5-hour video, it says there is like an herb that the grandma feeds. That's why she would only feed the thing. So Charlie was born, but when she was a baby, they like got rid of her soul to put Paimon's soul into Charlie. And throughout the movie, you see... when Annie is at Joan's house and she eats something, she like pulls out a little black speck in all of the
That's what
weed.
I thought of immediately when you said the herb. Yeah. I immediately was like, oh yeah, shit, that's what that was.
But in all of the weed that Peter is smoking is also some of that too.
That's why he started coughing.
Uh-huh. And feeling
that's
and
crazy.
After we'll get to this in a minute. So
yeah, I feel like I totally agree with you. I feel like it could go either way. I wasn't sure either. There are a lot of people who believe that she was like born as Payman, and maybe she had her eat that leaf shit to like
in
make
utero
it stick,
or whatever.
You know?
She like gave it to Toni Collette while she was pregnant, also potentially.
And obviously you probably have to cultivate like this baby's body to be a good host for this demon, you know. So maybe that's
but
part of it.
But nobody's more
vulnerable
than a baby.
Either way, I could see it either way. That's really, really interesting because there is that picture. There's a picture on the fridge of Grandma or Queen Lee holding Charlie and like feeding her looks like a burrito. And they're like, no, that's the weed thing. And I was like, okay, sure.
And there's also the miniature of miniature Grandma whipping her tit out to breastfeed miniature that baby shit. Charlie.
Yeah, that shit was so weird. Because like in the same monologue that we're talking about at the grief group, she's like, yeah, and then she like demanded that she feed the baby, and you think, oh, like she's bottle feeding the baby, like Grandma wants to hold the baby and give her the bottle. No. Later on in the miniature you see Grandma tit out. it's so fucking disturbing. And like you could think, oh, it's just an artistic representation. No, that's not what Annie does literally what happened. Mini size in her art.
Totally neutral views, like yes. No perspective at all or bias, whatever. Completely neutral. Totally
neutral view.
It's a neutral view of the scene.
I think that for me, one of the scenes that hit the most and really like sparked something in me this time around, and I couldn't pause the first time because this is the first time Adam had ever seen it. So I wanted him to like have the experience,
get the full effect,
but yeah. I went back is when Peter is in his history class and there's a lot going on, so you're not necessarily paying attention to what the history professor is saying. By the way, the history professor is in the cult.
Everybody's in the cult,
but he's definitely in it. But they're talking about the story of Heracles in this, and I have a little quote, that's a new word that I made
a
up
little
and
clout.
I hope that you like it. But yeah, so basically in this scene, the professor is talking about Sophocles' tragedy of the Woman of Trachis, sorry if I said that wrong, which centers on the Greek hero Heracles and his jealous wife Deianira. I think that's it. And she accidentally brings about Heracles' death with a poisoned robe. But his death was foretold to Deianira by an oracle. And so the teacher basically, they don't say that in the movie, but that's just some background. But the teacher is like, okay, like if it was foretold, like, is it more or less tragic that if he did have a choice or if he didn't have the choice? And one of the students says, I think it's more tragic because if it's all just inevitable, that means the characters have no hope and that they never had hope because they're just like pawns in this horrible, hopeless machine. Meanwhile, this is
free will, baby.
Peter is texting with his friend being like, you want to go smoke under the bleachers later? And I read really slow. So when I watched this the first time, I was really focusing on the text messages and not listening. But like this part of the movie, it's right in the beginning. It tells you everything. It's like there's nothing that, and you can argue it other ways, but there's nothing they could have done, in my opinion. Like everything was orchestrated by this cult. Everything.
Yeah, that's what's so interesting is like that scene is so fascinating the way it's shot to me because it's literally like an off-screen disembodied voice of some yes. other person in the classroom talking about being pawns in a horrible, hopeless machine. You have all of the miniatures, which is like they're just little dolls to be picked up yes. and moved around.
Oh, I
you
love
that.
You yeah.
have all of these like cultist people in their lives who are like moving the pieces on the game. Like, hey, let's go smoke later. Like, hey, come over to my house. Hey, I met you at this grief group. Like, hey, go to the prince. Like, they're all there manipulating the situation. I mean, they're very much running the show.
They're really running the show. What is the
But also
kid?
The text were
is
so
there
funny.
Is friend in the cult?
Yes.
Yeah, yes.
Smoke weed?
So
one of this,
oh,
yes.
I didn't notice that.
And Bridget. The girl.
Bridget
is that
is
the girl that he has a crush on?
Uh-huh.
Oh my God. Okay, well, the texts are so funny. Fuck. I just want to read them, but I'm sure I'll share them on social too. But you can see all of their texts are so funny because there's a funny one later on as well. But you see in the screenshot that Peter says, working, want to twirl around later? And then his friend says, sure, let me just finish waxing my D. And then Peter says, good luck, send pics. And then you see
love
the new text message, want to smoke a bullet break. I mean, I feel like, is that not how we also sometimes text each other? Like, what
that's
you
exactly.
That's, yeah.
Of course. Of course. Good luck, I just love picks. That.
That's very on brand.
Yeah. No, I love it.
And later when he invites him to the party, he's like, bring your dick.
Do you see the friend in like one of the cult scenes or something? I just missed that. I'm interested.
I didn't catch it myself, but IMDb trivia says that there's the man bun friend when they're smoking under the bleachers. And then you see a man bun teenage boy-ish at the end in the treehouse.
Okay. Oh, man. Yeah, because that makes sense. Because how the fuck were they going to orchestrate getting Peter to this party to put this in motion? Like, you know.
Yeah.
They had what? To do that.
All right. I've got a bone to pick with Miss Toni Collette Annie. Okay. Why are you... So I'm assuming that Peter is sophomore, junior, because he can drive, right? So he's like 16 or 17. Charlie is 13, so she is in seventh grade?
Eighth grade, maybe.
Why are you, as a parent, making your like... mid upper level high school kid bring their middle school sister to a party
to keep him from drinking?
But even then, you know that's not gonna happen. You're just putting her at a risk because they're teenagers, they're stupid, they're gonna drink, they're gonna smoke pot, they are gonna, you know, have bad sex. If
here's my take, Charlie, love her. She's a star. She's also kind of like a low freak weirdo a little bit. You know what I mean?
I think her mom
is like, I will do anything to try and get her around other people who are even approximately her age and have her socializing and have her like figuring out how to navigate through the world in that way. And maybe she'll make a friend and maybe she'll talk to somebody and maybe she won't spend all of her time cutting bird heads off and sticking them on dolls. You know what I mean? Like, it's a bad call because she knows there's going to be people drinking at this party, even if Peter himself is not drinking. But yeah, she's very much like, please, can we get Charlie to be interacting with other people in a normal way? Maybe, please.
But then also, if you have a child who has like this severe of an allergy, why don't you carry an EpiPen? They didn't have it at the funeral. They didn't send her with one.
Yeah, she should have an EpiPen on her.
At all times.
Keep that thing
on
you.
All family members should have one like in a purse, in a backpack, in a, like, if it's that severe, bad parenting.
You would really think that the dad who is a doctor would emphasize that more, because like, I'm willing to not let Toni Collette off the hook per se for a lot of this stuff, but I'm willing to rationalize a lot of her bad parenting decisions, because like, the model of parenting that she had was not ideal. So she probably is like, I am 1,000 times better than the parenting that I got, and I turned out a successful artist, so presumably I'm doing a lot better than, you know, was done for me, and she doesn't necessarily see, like, what more is there to be done, you know what I mean? Like, her parents both had a lot of challenges that they were facing in their own lives, as long as they were alive, even, and they weren't always alive. Like, we don't know exactly when her dad died, but I think it was when she was pretty young.
She was super young, yeah.
Yeah, so I think I'm like willing to say that maybe she doesn't fully appreciate some of the realities, but it is really interesting considering that they talk about it at the funeral scene. Like, clearly they don't trust Charlie to not eat things with nuts in it. I mean, I kind of wonder, like, maybe the allergy isn't so serious on its own necessarily, because like, she can eat a Hershey's bar, which is for sure made in a factory that processes nuts and stuff like that, even if that particular Hershey's bar doesn't have nuts. And like, she eats the cake at the party and is chilling for quite a long time, just wheezing before she starts to feel bad enough to go to Peter. I think it's like more mild than it seems, considering that we see her go into anaphylaxis. But time elapses and Charlie's not taking it seriously. Her family has clearly not impressed upon her that this could be serious. Like, they have an EpiPen for her, but they don't carry it around. Nobody here is taking it seriously.
I think another perspective too is like similar to but different Signs, when they go down in the basement and they don't take Morgan's inhaler when he has very severe asthma. Like, I know that was a crisis situation, but they're also in a crisis situation here. The cloud of that hangs over your head on your like cognition and your clear thinking when you're in grief, even though she didn't like her grandma or her mom, Annie didn't like her mom, like there is so much that you just lose in those moments after losing someone who's a big part of your life. And so it could be a part of that too. She's not thinking clearly because she's got a lot going on in her mind right now because of all of the, again, fuck shit that's been happening in the last couple of months. Because it's not just that the grandma died. It's also that she was being very disturbing leading up to that. There's that one diorama piece where like Queen Lee is like in the doorway, staring at them sleeping. Like, she's obviously been having some weird stuff going on leading up to it. There's been a lot of stress leading up. So I can see that too. Again, I agree with you, Sydney. Bad parenting. Mm-hmm. But I think that.
Just trying to get through the day kind of stuff.
Totally. But yeah, there's so many little details that lead up to the big bang that is about to occur here in what we're talking about. Like, one, we got Charlie cutting off the head of that bird earlier. That's happening.
Oh my God.
Apparently, also, I didn't clock this, but when Peter goes up to smoke weed with his girly pop and his friends, two people are laying on the bed, just casually watching a video of someone being guillotined.
I think they also were cult members.
Probably. Everybody. Yeah.
Because
everybody fucking seems to be.
There was incredible, similarity that I wouldn't have noticed. We see these two girls cutting up all the giant amount of walnuts to put in this cake. I mean,
every party needs 1,000 walnuts, Sydney. What are you talking about? I always have 1,000 walnuts at my parties.
But the speed of which they are chopping, like the knife is going, is the exact same speed that later in the movie Annie is banging her head against the wall.
Oh, that's so interesting. Because there was also that moment where Annie was like chopping tomatoes and it sounded like the rhythmic clicking that Charlie does sometimes.
Ooh, the clicking is my favorite part of this movie. I love that Charlie has a little weird click tick like that. I think that it's a fun one and it must be very unsettling. But to have that follow you around after death. Oh, I remember the first time I heard one of those post-death clicks in the movie theater. I almost shit myself. I'm so fucking scared. But anyway, this brings us to the big bang of this movie. Because, you know, Charlie comes up. She's in full anaphylaxis. She's freaking out. High as a kite, Peter has to start driving her home. It's so sad. It's so fucking sad because, like, again, we know this. It was foretold. There's nothing he could have done. This shit was planned to a T. Those people, the cult members, put that deer in the road. 100%.
They marked the pole ahead of time.
They marked the pole. The pole has the mark on it. They knew exactly what they were doing. And it's just like crazy that they have a plan that would work this well. But also, baby Payman is inside of Charlie. I think like this is part of what makes me believe that, like, I don't know, he's already in there for sure. But like, maybe she always had him in her. Like, it's giving Rosemary's Baby to me. That like the seed was planted in utero. Because like, why else would she like pull her whole body out of the car like that? I get that she was going for fresh air, but like, there had to be something inside of Charlie like leading her to being in the exact right place, otherwise it wouldn't happen either. But yeah, her head gets bashed off by a pole.
But also, clearly she just I mean, with the allergy stuff, she clearly does not have that much, like, regard for her own health and safety, necessarily. It's not that she, like, wants to die, per se, no. But she's just not... She's not taking it seriously at all. Like, you see that in the beginning, too, when the dad goes and wakes her up in the treehouse, and he's like, you could get pneumonia out here. Like, you could get hypothermia out here. And she's just like, it's okay. And that's something she says a couple of times throughout the movie when confronted with something concerning. She's just like, it's okay. And that's never really an answer even to what someone is saying to her. She's just, like, so nonchalant about it all.
Yeah. Oh my god. Yeah, that when I first saw this scene when the head got blasted off, that was one of the most shocking things I'd ever seen in a movie. It was just like, and the aftermath, I mean, I gotta hand it to Naked Brothers Band, to Alex Wolff. Like, I'm a Naked Brothers Band hater because I thought they were trying to jack the Jonas Brothers swag when I was a huge Jonas Brothers fan. So I always was such a hater of the Naked Brothers Band. I thought they were lame, but it's like, he's come back. He's a horror king now. And he was in Oppenheimer, right? So he's got a lot going on. But anyway, his acting was really incredible in this moment afterwards, because, like, what do you do? Like, you didn't.
It's so believable. It's not, like, yeah. You are in one, he's high, two, he's a literal child. Yeah. You just. It's, what else is so there to hard. Do, quite frankly?
Because it's like, I get why later on Annie wants to put, like, the blame on him. I understand how she could get there, whatever. You always are looking for someone to blame. But, like, it's terrible because he's going to blame himself because, yeah, he was driving the car and, yeah, he swerved and her head got bashed off. So, like, yeah, it's his fault in that regard. But we know, or we find out by the end of the movie, like, it was always going to be this way. Like, oh, my God, it's so terrible. And his reaction is just so, like, wrong and so human. This relates to what you were saying a couple episodes ago, Jesus Christ, Chelsea, about maybe The Descent.
Yeah, about, like, what you do
in a, yeah, about Juno, and, like, what you do when you're faced with, like, the most horrifying thing, and sometimes you just shut down. I didn't agree with you then, but in this case, I think it's different. But yeah, he just shuts down. He leaves the head.
It is such a wild scene, and I think it's so interesting, especially when you consider, like, all of the meddling from the cult members. Like you said, like, he was smoking weed in the other room, you know what I mean? Like, he did kind of, that one was on him, like, that he was the one that approached the girl that he likes to be like, hey, I have weed, you want to go smoke? Yeah. But, you know, he is now in a compromised position. He is at a house party where people are drinking and doing drugs, so maybe that's why he doesn't call 911 in the first place and is like, I'll drive her to the hospital myself. Maybe he thinks there's not time and he has to do this is going to be the fastest. Like, yeah. Maybe someone else told him, you got to get her to the hospital right now. Maybe there was, like, intervention in that sense too. But it's so interesting because in that moment, like, after she got bonked, which I
put it.
Yeah, I mean, I knew ahead of the time about the bonk. But it is, well, it was, like, so hard to avoid knowing about the bonk if you didn't see the movie right away. It was so widely discussed everywhere. Everyone was so shocked. Everyone, like, could not help themselves, and I don't blame them. But it also is, like, one of the I waited a long time also to watch this movie. I think I waited a couple of years and then, like, watched it during quarantine. But it's so interesting because, like I said, Charlie does she says, that's okay. I checked my notes. She doesn't say it's okay. She says, that's okay about the pneumonia sleeping out in the treehouse. And when her mom is like, you want to go to the party? She's like, that's okay. And she means no. But this is something that she says. And then in that moment, when Peter is just, like, sitting there frozen, processing, he says, you okay? Okay. And then he, like, slowly starts, not even like starts to drive again. It's almost like he just takes his foot off the gas and the car starts rolling and he lets the momentum take him. Like he's moving so slow in that moment. Like he truly is just like, brain is off, autopilot is on. But it is,
it's so human. It's just one of the other tropes that I really love throughout the rest of the movie is how, like, you know, in this scene, he looks up, he looks in the rearview mirror and he looks away because he can't bear to look at what's back there. And then the rearview mirror shows up at least once. I don't know if it's multiple times.
I think just the one time in class.
I think it's just that one time in class. And it's just, oh my God. Like that's the image for me. Just like him looking back for just a second and he knows there's nothing he can do. It's over. It's already done. She's not wheezing anymore because she doesn't have a head. And it's just horrifying. And he just drives home and he just goes to bed. I mean, like, I remember being like, what the fuck? But also like, what's he going to do? Hey, mom, I decapitated Charlie. Like, I don't know. What do you do? No one knows what to do in that situation. Hopefully we never have to find out.
Yeah, it's so interesting to me. And I think part of it that is so telling is the way that he goes home. And it's like he doesn't even close the door to his bedroom when he goes and gets in bed. He just crawls into bed. Autopilot. He doesn't sleep at all. He just lies there with his eyes open.
Waiting.
For the discovery.
Yeah.
And that wail from Toni Collette, from Annie, when she discovers it. She's like, I'm gonna go get Oscar. Some... Seriously, she's like, I'm gonna go get some balsa wood. You need anything? Oh my God. And you find
the way that it starts off screen in that scene, continues on screen when she's like on the floor begging to die, continues to when she's at the gravesite and they're lowering the coffin down into the grave.
The camera lowering with the coffin. I thought that was such a cool shot. And it goes underground with her. Like, oh, it's like, hello, everyone. Here's act fucking two.
It's something that is interesting about this scene is, like, you notice the lights, like, flashes kind of throughout the movie. But they're like, you're kind of like, what's the deal with this? What's the deal with the lights? There's a little bit here. There's a little bit there. You really notice it in that wailing scene. And it's lightning outside. But considering what we know of the light and the way that it kind of, like, moves through and is sort of representative of, like, Paimon's spirit taking over a host or whatever. Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting to see the way that the sky is lighting up, sending flashes around the room, little light spots around the room in that moment. It's very interesting.
See, because there is a moment, correct me if I'm wrong, there is a moment where Charlie sees the light, right?
In a room, yeah.
Yeah. So that makes me think that maybe Charlie is a person herself, but she does share the body with Paimon. I don't think that necessarily negates that she could have been born with Paimon inside of her. I feel like that still could go either way. But, like, I think they are probably separate because I was like, because that's, like, and everything I read, like, that's supposed to be him. But, like, how can it be him if, like, and she sees it and she's like, oh, what the fuck, you know? I think they are, like, sharing the body maybe a little bit, or maybe there's a bit of her.
I think there's also room for Paimon to be attached to her body, but not inhabiting her body. Like, he can be kind of almost like he's haunting her, you know what I mean?
True. I think that he is in her body because he needs a host, but also he's unhappy. He doesn't like a girl host.
Yeah,
because he is a dude and he thrives in a male host and, like, you know what? That's his prerogative.
Everybody should get to have a body that matches their own gender identity.
What they want.
I totally agree. Like, Paimon wants what he wants and he gets it, does he not? But one of the color story things that I didn't read a lot about this, but one of you was mentioning it, so I'd love to hear Sydney. More, was that teal is the color of Paimon. Apparently, historically, and in books maybe, yellow is the color of Paimon. But in this movie, teal is the color of Paimon because the light is always teal. But something I just thought of now, I didn't think about how the casket's teal. Charlie's casket is teal.
When Annie is going to grief counseling, and she keeps telling Steve she's going to the movies. She's not. She doesn't want to talk about going to grief counseling. She meets Joan, who jumps out at her because she's about to leave. Mm-hmm. And Joan gives her her number. She's like, well, if you decide to call me, like, do that. When we see after Charlie is dead, Annie is working on her miniatures. She spills over, like, a bottle of ink.
Oh.
And it's a teal ink on Joan's number. And that's when she calls her.
And it almost looks this. Like the it bottle goes... kind of, like, jumps
no,
over.
No, no.
Its...
Get this, babes. It is literally payment. In that shot, I rewatched it. In the corner of the room, you see the light. And she does not knock it over. Payment knocks it over.
That's what I was saying, is it almost seemed like it, like, fell over itself. And so that makes but, a lot yeah. of sense if, like, you can literally see a representation of him on screen.
Yeah, the light is in the corner. I never would have fucking seen that. And I didn't notice that she didn't knock it over herself, because I was looking at a different part of the screen or something. Just so many good details. I love that. I love Joni also. She is
She's
so
great.
Psychotic and amazing.
And Dad, like, did a really great job.
Yeah, it's just being in that vulnerable, grieving spot. You're looking for someone to tell you that they're going to be okay, or that you're going to be okay, or looking for someone who's a little further down the road in that journey, who, like, maybe is at a little more peace than you are. And so, like, oh my God, I just feel so bad. She's so vulnerable, and it's so easy for her to be taken in by Joni. And Joni's also so fucking sweet. And her sob story is fucking terrible. She tells Joni, like, yeah, my son died and my grandson died at the same time they drowned together. Like, that's a terrible story. She's like, wow, like, oh, she has it even worse than me. And look, she's doing okay. So she wants to believe her. She wants to have someone to lean on, because, like, her family at this point has completely fallen apart. She can't sleep in the same bed as her husband, Steve. She can't even speak to her son. Like, she's looking for something somewhere, and Joni comes right in.
But also, it's so interesting the way that Joni introduces the concept of the seance, because, like, the concept of the seance was introduced earlier in the movie. You have a shot of, like, the mail slot where you see that it's, like, 0% APR down, blah, 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 whatever. Like, it's just junk mail. And then you see a flyer, like, slipped in on top of the mail that was already there, which is an invitation for an open seance. Mm-hmm. But clearly, Annie's not taking it. Like, Annie is not willing to go to that on her own. She needs Joan to, like, come in, befriend her, be a trusted figure, and then bump into her. Oh, just coincidentally bump into her at the craft store, which she's like, where she's buying a chalkboard, by the way.
I love that detail. She's like, this is my grandson's chalkboard. No, bitch, you bought it at Michael's.
Yeah, but the way that she, like, really goes out of her way to intervene in that scene, and, like, it's such a weird scene, and you can see Annie, like, completely resisting it at first, but also she's not talking about any of this with anyone else in her life. Her husband doesn't even know that she goes to grief group. Like, she needs someone, something to hang on to, and she thinks it can be Joan, and Joan is, like, making it seem really promising and like she's a safe space to talk about all of this stuff that's going on. Toni Collette has that, like, incredible scene where she's talking about finding the body in the car, and it's so heart-wrenching, and her voice in that moment, like, it is incredible. It is so powerful, the way that it cuts from the moment outside the craft store to, like, the light, like, the match, just the match as it, like, illuminates but that cut is so crazy, the way that the light slowly comes up in the room, almost as if, like, your eyes are adjusting to the dark too. Like, it is so, well done.
It's a beautifully crafted movie. I just, the sound design, the cinematography, everything, like, and this is a debut movie. This is fucking debut feature
length. Which is wild.
I really want to watch his two shorts.
His S-tussy?
He did two shorts before this. He put his whole ass-tussy. Good God. Good for you, Ari. That works too well, actually. Weird.
He did that on purpose.
But yeah, he has two like short films that he did beforehand. One is like something Johnson's. They're both movies about like fuck shit again happening with families. Like it's a family drama horror. Something is wrong with the family. Something is broken in the family. And so it's great that he got to play it out for so long in this, because there's just so much. I mean, I think this scene comes before the seance, the like breakdown scene at the dinner table.
Yeah.
Where Annie finally
fucking face starts, on your like, face.
Fucking goes crazy on, well, I mean, not crazy, but she goes off on her son.
She loses her shit.
Yeah, she loses her shit. That pop off scene, queen. I was like, it's so horrible. It's so horrible. There's so much. I understand everyone's perspective, and it's all bad, and it's all just like really the worst comes out of people when you're grieving, and it's just like it's really, really hard. But that scene, I was listening to it, I was watching it, and I was like, why do I know every word of this speech? Like, I couldn't recite it for you right now, but I was like, the next word was in my head before the one before it. I didn't have the subtitles on because Adam doesn't like those. You want to know why?
Why?
Because I watched one of those fucking videos that was like this trend on TikTok where people make a playlist of every word of a monologue, and so every song is the words, like song title is the word of a monologue. So I read every single word, and it was like playing at the same time the monologue, and I'm an audio visual like written learner.
Same.
So it stuck with me in all the ways, and I was like, wow, it's really gonna be in there. Because yeah, like you're saying this way earlier, this movie sinks its teeth in. It really sticks with you. And there are scenes in this movie that like I can see it in my mind. It'll never fucking go away. And I usually have a terrible memory. We all know this. But like this one, it's
like Sydney said, it lingers.
It lingers.
It loves to linger.
Ugh. But yeah,
scored
I just
by
to
the cranberries
on that part. Oh, what a great song. but back to the seance. The seance is so insane, and I mean, like, what do you do when you're confronted with that? You know, you have to believe it. I would believe it. Also, especially, she's searching for something, searching for her daughter everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, it's so much, because like I conflated those two scenes a little bit a minute ago, but there's the like first meeting at Joan's house where Toni Collette is like talking about finding the body, and she's also revealing that she also has her own like mental health issues where she was sleepwalking and she woke up in Peter and Charlie's shared room and she doused herself in paint thinner and she had a lit match in her hand and Peter woke
Peter
up and saw her
paint thinner.
Yeah, she was about
wild
to get them all, and she says she was sleeping. She obviously didn't mean to do it. She's trying to take responsibility for it, but also like doesn't want to take responsibility for any of the decision making behind any of this, because she says she was sleepwalking, but the timing was awful because they'd been in a quarreling phase. And so you have that whole moment, and then you also have this seance later with the lit match, like illuminating that whole scene, bringing it all together, and the fight in between it, sandwiched in between, where she's yelling at him, being like, nobody wants to take responsibility for anything. Like,
yeah.
Why won't you take responsibility for this? Meanwhile, she's sort of taking responsibility and also not at all taking any responsibility.
No one here is doing anything perfectly, which like, no, how can you, how can anyone, we're human. But like it goes back to what you were saying earlier, Chelsea, when we were first bringing up the like mental illness aspects of this, and I didn't think about it in that way about how icky it is, but this is reminding me now. It is such a trope in movies, and I can't tell you an example right now, but I've seen it so many times before where they're like, this woman had an episode in the past, and so now no one trusts anything she's saying in the present, and like when there's actual shit going on. And then there's the movies are always about like, is it real, is it fake, is it real, is it fake? And so like I didn't realize that this kind of falls into that, because she's had not just her familial history of mental illness, but she's had this episode where she almost killed her children. Did she put it on Charlie too, or just Peter? I think both, it was of, both them. Of them.
Yeah, okay, both of them. Because they shared a room at the time, which is also so interesting. Like, why would they ever be sharing a room? I mean, maybe they lived in a different house before. Maybe it was while the grandma was living with them. And, like, grandma kind of has her own room. But also maybe they, I don't know. I don't know.
I think there's a lot of reasons for that. A lot of families have their kids share a room. But, yeah, and then later on, too, when she has her sleepwalking come back, and she has that vision of Peter covered in all the ants. And I forgot about the bugs. I was like, you were like, oh, there's a lot of bugs in this. I was like, what do you mean there's a lot of bugs in this? Yeah, you're right. Yeah. There's a lot
of bugs.
Monica,
how could you, Miss Bug Girl,
forget about bugs? A lot of other stuff to think about, okay?
Yeah, the ants covering his face is such a disturbing scene to me. That whole thing is so fucked up, but the way that they're like coming in from the window and they lead her to Peter's room and they're covering his face, but then it's all a dream, and then he's like, you're sleepwalking, and they have this like little terrifying interaction where she's like, is Charlie here? And he's like, why are you scared of me? And she says, I never wanted to be your mother. Clocks her hands over her mouth. Like, that whole interaction is so revealing also for her to be like, I didn't want to have kids in the first place. I didn't ever feel like a mother. I tried to do everything I could to like induce a miscarriage. I'm glad it didn't work. I love my child. I love you, Peter. But also there was so much baggage that came with motherhood and having a child that like she just didn't want to do it. And then like that smash cut to you look to her and she's drenched and she has the match again. Oof. Oh my God. Oh. It is woof.
So brilliant.
Cut to it's another dream. She's in fucking Peter's face. My God.
Yeah. Oh my God. When she wakes him up also later on to start doing the seance and he's literally like, they're literally like, so close
nose
to each other
to nose.
Inches.
Yes.
Nose to nose. It's like you ever wake up and your mommy's like in your fucking zone. Like
that would freak
me out. And I love that mommy.
Yeah. I mean, that's part of what is so interesting to me about this scene right after the car accident. Because like if I had a mom who had sleptwalk in the past and almost lit me on fire after dousing me in paint thinner, I'd probably sleep with my door locked. But he leaves his door wide open in that scene. Like he has like multiple moments with his mommy in his room being scary. He has that dream that she's trying to pull his head off. There's a lot of like baggage going on there between them. But the fact that
she... I don't
know
how you reestablish trust, you know, after that and then after
what
happens
to Charlie. You have
to go
to therapy. Oh my God, you have to go to therapy and they just never do.
And not the group therapy where everyone's a cult. Guy or
yeah
person.
Not that kind
not
of
that one
well
not that
yeah
one.
I mean I guess that also like kind of if they had even gone to therapy, you know, would that have helped? Because probably they would have had a cult member as their therapist and then that
it
would have been
the purpose.
Yeah, I mean there's nothing they could have done. They were doomed from the beginning. But this seance scene is so interesting because when she runs into Joan outside of the craft store, Joan is like, I went to a seance and saw a medium. And then she invites Annie to her house. Suddenly, Joan is the fucking medium and is the one who knows how to do everything. She teaches Annie how to do it. Suddenly, Annie is a fucking medium and knows how to do everything. Like, it's so interesting the way that even is sort of being like passed along between them. She's giving her all of the instructions for how to invite Paimon back into the house. She's like, here's the chant you need to do. Make sure your son is there. I'm not going to mention him specifically. I'm just going to say you need every member of your family. Yeah, for energy purposes. But woof, the way that she gets all of the pieces in place and the way that Annie wakes them up at 1:45 in the morning to do this.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's so scary. She's like, I'm a medium now. She like literally says that. She's like, it sounds crazy. I'm a medium. Like, it's so hard because I read this article and it was great. It gave me so many details on little things to notice. It was awesome. It's linked. I think it was Collider. But it said that in the free will versus it was all said by the Oracle thing, they say that Annie made the choice to do the seance in her house And so it's also sad because she like brought this upon the family. And I just don't necessarily think that that's fair, because I feel like no matter what, this cult was going to make that shit happen. If Joni had to fucking go to their house and do it with her there, she would have made it happen, because it had to happen for this to happen, for any of the rest of the movie to occur. And so they were going to make that happen no matter what. So I don't know. I like the idea of them. I like the idea of predetermination in this moment.
Well, it's not predetermination if it's human beings setting the stage and moving the pieces. You know what I mean?
The Oracle, Queen Lee, said it would happen, and so it's going to go down even after she died. Not that she's
the thing. It's not predetermination if it's not like they already know exactly how everything's going to play out. It's like, you know, there's a zillion of them. They can adjust as needed. The seance flyer didn't work. Okay, Joan's going to introduce the idea of the seance. Yeah.
They're very resourceful. Good for them, I guess. Bad for Annie.
Yeah, I think exactly what you're saying is right. If Annie didn't make the choice to do it at that time, and like, there is some responsibility for making that choice, maybe. But if she didn't do that at that time, they were going to get her to do it some other different way at some other different time.
Yeah.
Or they would have done it them fucking selves.
I think it had to be her. I think it had to be her, but I think there are a thousand different ways. Hand. You know, yeah, and I mean, she's very vulnerable.
Yeah, it's so upsetting, because obviously these are like supernatural stakes here, but like this is like a real thing that happens to families who are grieving. They're taken advantage of all the time. You're just like, your defenses are down. You're looking for anything. And so
people are taken in by regular psychics and mediums.
Exactly. Yeah. All the fucking time.
I love psychics. It's a scam.
I know. I've thought about it. I have a friend who lost someone close to them, and they had a really positive experience. Same. And I was like, you know what? I'm not going to fucking yuck your yum. That's awesome. I don't know if I am in a place to want to do that, because you know I get freaked out by the Ouija board
inviting
shit.
Spirits, yeah,
yeah. And now after watching Talk to Me, which you know we got into that a couple weeks ago.
Monica, did you go with me one time in LA to see Sophia, my psychic?
No, I didn't. You just told me about her all the time. I would go to a psychic. That kind of thing is fun.
I know.
I don't know.
Did you meet up with us after to get coffee? Because I remember that.
I don't, you know, you're talking to me, and my memory is really bad. So,
well,
the only thing I remember is Charlie's head getting blown off in this movie. So, did you have a positive psychic experience?
Oh my God. My therapist was like, what does your psychic say about this? And I was this is what Sophia is
saying. They're collaborating. They're working together.
It's
try
great.
From all angles. Go for
exactly.
it.
Exactly. I saw my therapist weekly, and I saw my psychic at least quarterly.
Yeah. There are people who I think could have those abilities, but I just like a lot of the time.
A lot of people are
on grieving
scammers,
families and they scam and they scam and they scam. So it's just interesting to think about this in like that mundane circumstance, like, because this is just a big crazy version of that happens all the time. So
in the same way that like there are lots of great charities, and then there are also some charities that are scams to pay their high level executives lots of money.
Yeah exactly.
Anything could really be vulnerable to scamming. I mean, you just gotta be wary and smart.
But things really fucking go off the rails when the seance happens. Literally, like, Annie gets possessed by Charlie/Payman for a second there. That shit was so disturbing. I did not remember that. And I just also think, like, yeah, it's scary when you see in Joan's seance that Payman is writing on the chalkboard, but having like the full blown drawings be like appearing. Ah, God, that was so unsettling.
I love that they did that in a separate scene, too, from the actual seance. Because I love that they sort of, like, they give you enough to freak out Peter and to have the dad be like, enough, stop. Like, he throws the water on her to be like, get, like, snap out of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's easy to write off why there was, like, no writing in that scene. Because, like, a little piece of chalk that's standing up on a chalkboard moving around, sure. To have to pick up a whole pen is, like, now we're levitating stuff. And we're just not at the levitating portion of the film yet. But the way that you, like, see the drawings appear later, like, you hear the scratching on the paper when she's, like, going into the room, you see the pages like flipping just on flipping their own. Flipping.
Oh,
but it happens when she's alone. And so again, it's the kind of thing where it's like, you're not totally sure what's happening yet. You've seen objects move. You've seen people get freaked out. But also, how willing are you to accept that there is like a demon or something happening at this time? Nobody has mentioned it yet until the scene where Peter is in class and he like has that moment. I think that's the moment where he sees the rear view mirror, but I'm not sure. But when he sees his reflection
with the smile.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree. I put it in my notes. Did this moment, is this the genesis for the whole movie smile? Because when the dad gets the phone call later, the dad is saying that, like, apparently Peter said that he thought he was being haunted by some sort of vengeful spirit. Something was after him, some sort of demon. Like, that's the first time people put words to it in that way in the film. And it's so interesting that you're getting it, like, secondhand from a character who doesn't really know about any of this, like, symbology stuff that's going on. I don't know if I just made up that word. But he is, like, detached from all of that for the most part, other than, you know, even Charlie was the one who was mainly seeing, like, strangers staring her at the street. Like, that hasn't happened to Peter so much yet. And it is just really interesting that that's the way that they feed it back to you in those words, that that's the first time those words are brought into the movie.
So another thing that's interesting, because I kind of conflate all the little Peter parts. I can't tell you exactly the order, but so maybe we talk about them all together. So Peter, he smokes the weed under the staircase and he has that like panic attack sort of thing where he can't breathe. And like, yes, we talked about the witch's wart, I don't know, witch's weed was in there with the normal weed, that spooky ganja, so he like starts, his throat starts closing up. I read that as like panic attack at first, but obviously there's more to it. It's Ari Aster. It's also him starting to like feel the symptoms that Charlie felt like as she was dying, like his throat closing up, like her throat was closing up during the anaphylaxis. Later on in the very, very scary part, where Peter has just been screamed at by Joan across the street, she screams out some of those words. She screams Satoni,
yeah,
Degoni, Eparagon. And Satoni was a word that was on the wall in Charlie's room, which I can explain what those ones mean. But they basically just summoned some shit. Satoni, that one is supposed to be a command that sends the dead back to the spirit world. So, like, that makes a lot of sense in the end of the movie when, like, all these people have just died and they want them to vacate the bodies so, like, payment can be in there for real. I'm not exactly sure why that was written on the wall in Charlie's room. That doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. There's also the word Zazos is on the wall in another one. Mm-hmm. And this one, like, that it's related to a man named Aleister Crowley, who was a supernatural occultist man.
Oh, an OG.
And he did all these like excursions in Algiers. And during one of his excursions, he summoned a demon called Charanzon. And like, in order to invoke that demon, he used the mantra Zazas, Zazas, Nastastanda, Zazas. Am I gonna get killed right now? Oh my god, wait.
Why would you do that?
She's chanting.
Why would you do that, Monica?
I'm sorry, it's a podcast. It is an audio, it is an oral tradition. Anyway,
this
it's fine.
Is
I'm
just
not holding
like
any books.
Evil Dead.
I know, I'm just like fucking stupid ass. What is his name?
Listening
Eric?
To the tapes.
Listening to the tapes. But But yeah, that's where that word came from. And there's also Liftoch Pandemonium, which is written, I don't remember where that was in. I think it was in maybe Annie's office. That one was written. I'm not sure. But
that was right after the seance scene with the candle where it like flamed out and then like lit back up.
Yeah. Apparently, like, Pandemonium is associated with Milton's Paradise Lost, and it's a place that Lucifer creates for those who fall from grace. And then Liftoch, I'm not sure how to say it, is a Hebrew word meaning to open to and to unlock. So it's like unlocking the Pandemonium, this like devil created world. So that makes a lot of sense too. But yeah, it doesn't really make sense why she's saying Satoni Dagoni at Paragon, apparently, but it's all right because they are scary words and that scene is so scary. I just love that the words, like, I was like, oh, he made up a language and I'm fine with just it just being that, but no, they all mean something and they're all really scary and my soul's gonna be taken from my body now because I said them out loud. Isn't that great?
I think it's so fun that they also picked a real demon or like a real thing. But I will say they did make some minor changes. The symbol of payment, it's the three like the swirly things and stuff, which in real life it's four, but they whittled it down to three.
Let's not curse this movie.
They didn't want to curse the movie, number. And three represents the mom, Annie, and Charlie also.
Triangle. Holy Trinity.
Yeah.
The triangle Trinity. Shape pops up a lot in the film, too. Yeah. That's another one of the symbols.
Is an important part of the summoning.
And also, it looks like 666 a little bit.
Yes,
so.
It does. It totally does. That's good visually for the layman who doesn't know about Satoni and Liftemonium or whatever. I just put them all together. Yeah, that's when you find out also that the teacher is part of the cult, because the teacher kind of like summons Peter down the hallway. He like
into his classroom
through the window, and he's like, come here closer. And you also see Payman's little light. How cute. But I'm not sure which comes first, but at some point in the movie, we get Annie realizing that shit's fucked with Joan, because she goes back to her house and we see in Joan's house all of the iconography is in there. That's that symbol that we were just talking about. There's also a beautiful depiction of the final scene of the film is splayed out with mini figurines, including the figurine that Charlie made at the beginning of the movie with the pigeon head. That's what that was. I did not understand that at all. And those three animal heads that you see, there's like a bunny and like something else. And we should post this picture on social because it's really cool to see. That those are the heads that were in that shoebox at the beginning of the movie that you don't actually see, but those are where those heads come into play. But we know now that Joan is a part of this. Annie knows that this is a part of this, and she had always been skeptical because of that cute little doormat. But she goes back home, opens up this box, and finds all of this evidence of how Joan's a part of the cult. There's some freak shit going on, and she finds a book, and it tells you all about Payman, and it shows you this image of Payman. And when when Peter gets like real real possessed for that moment, when his arm shoots up and does the weird thing,
the creepy arm,
he is mimicking the image of Payman in the book. And that is something I never would have put together without this article. And it was literally in the comments, not even in the articles, through the comments. That's where the real shit is going down. But yeah, if you look at the image, Payman is holding this staff, and the staff is an arm that's like straight up with a weird hand thing. And it's the exact hand thing that that Peter is doing. And also, some people say that the way that his face looks is like he looks like he's having an allergic reaction, like the anaphylaxis that Charlie was experiencing. So that's part of it. But also, and this might be me stretching it a little bit, but if you look at the image of Payman, there's like he has this weird thing with his eyes. One of his eyes is in shadow and the other one has this like big like lid thing that kind of looks like eyelashes above it. And it it looks like the eye thing that is happening to Peter, where his eyelid is flipped up on one eye and his eyelashes are all stuck up too. So that's like another parallel. I think it's both the anaphylaxis and that. It's, oh, that I was so giddy when I read that. I was like, genius. I was always confused about the arm.
Yeah, I mean, it is very easy to write off a lot of things in this movie as creepy for creepy's sake. Yes. And I mean, probably some of that is just creepy for creepy's sake. I don't know. Maybe there is more meaning in Toni Collette crawling around the house at the end and the way that she does crawl around the house. Maybe there is something deeply spiritual, or there's something about time. There's lore that I don't have access to. I don't know. But it is so, it's one of those things where, like, it's so interesting to see where this symbol, like the deeper meaning is clear once you know what to look for and what is still there, like waiting to be uncovered. And then like what is maybe just, yeah, it's fucking scary. But it's really interesting. And I mean, it makes sense in that Ari Aster, like, did not set out to make a horror film at first. He wrote the original draft of this script as just a straight family drama, and then he decided to adapt it into becoming a horror film. So, like, he really wanted all of the scares to be emotionally rooted in these, like, character beats rather than just, like, spooky jump scare. But I, the way that every little moment, the way he's doing so much with it is, it's so fascinating. And the way that things just come back around, like, you have, when she digs through the notes on spiritualism book at the end and she finds the lore on payment that he needs a vulnerable body and he prefers a male host, but you also got her looking at that book in the very beginning, and there's the note from the mom that says, like, our sacrifice will pale next to the rewards. And then that, you know, you never see that note again. But if you rewatch the film, knowing what happens and knowing who set those elements in play and got the ball rolling, that note is also fuck shit because, yeah, Queen Lee's just out here being like, well, we're serving a greater purpose. So, like, sorry to your family, sorry to my family, but shit's really gonna pay off for everybody else.
Seriously, I don't know. He put his whole ass twisty into this, every little detail. I just loved truly the arm thing. I loved the arm thing.
It's so spooky.
It's so itsy, yeah. Ah, man. And he just smashes the fucking shit out of his face. What's the movie where someone does that on a pencil? Because I thought it was this movie.
Oh. Yuck. I feel like we've covered it, but we just watched it.
They like smash a. Oh, it's the Joker, Batman.
It's Batman.
Yeah,
I was thinking he was going to smash Joker his face onto a pencil.
Smashes a guy's like eyeball or something onto the pencil. It is
maybe I just conflated those in my memory. I thought there was one where someone gets possessed into smashing their face onto a pencil, but.
That sounds really familiar, Monica. I don't know. I'm searching my notes for any mentions of pencils, and I'm finding some spooky pencils, but not necessarily.
There's a lot of terrifying pencils out there.
Yeah.
But anyway, there's so many details, but I think we're at, like, the big final shitstorm. What do we think, yeah?
Yeah, because, I mean, that's pretty much the moment. The dad brings Peter home, gets him in bed, and Annie is full-blown freaking out because she has discovered her decapitated mom's body in the attic. She's seen the symbols. Oh, she now all recognizes the symbols because she saw it on the Charles welcome mat. She saw it on the necklaces. She saw Joan in the album and all of this stuff. So, like, she has an idea of, she doesn't know what she's looking at, but she is putting pieces together. And she is realizing that she's the one that, like, brought it in that moment. Yeah. She had that earlier scene where she tried to burn the notebook and her arm started to light on fire. So she pulled it out. So she knows that there is now a connection of some sort of supernatural link between the family and the notebook. She thinks it's only her. So she thinks that she can just, like, sacrifice herself at this point and totally. Be done with it. And she's like, I can't do it myself because I'm scared and it's gonna hurt and I don't know, but I want to do it, so I need you to do it for me, husband. Like, please do this for me so I can save my son.
But yeah, this part was such a fucking shock to me too, because I didn't get it. I didn't get like how what happened could possibly happen, because basically Annie's like, Steve, I need you to throw this in the fire, like, because, and it's going to kill me. And I love you so much that, like, I love you little speech that she gives to, so passionate and heartbreaking.
Oh my God, I wrote it. She's all like, down.
I'm about to fucking die. And he's like about to do it, but then he's like, you know what? Like, I'm not gonna like egg you indulge on anymore. You. Mm-hmm. Indulge. Thank you. I couldn't think of that word. I'm not gonna indulge you in your not flights of fantasy, because
he thinks it's a delusion.
It's a fucking nightmare. Yeah, I'm not gonna indulge your delusions anymore, because only making it worse. And it's just like, no, it's actually real. It's so frustrating in that moment. I turned to Adam, I'm like, would you believe me? And he said, I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, listen.
But also, there's like a lot of history here, but also like, fuck you.
But here's the, you know, that's my like number one like relationship thing. Like, when I say something is wrong, you cannot tell me that I'm mentally ill. I know I'm mentally ill.
Well, it just
but that is separate. That is separate from this.
But in this moment, I'm also, I know what's going on. Okay,
I'm also correct.
He also wouldn't like look at anything. Like, he wouldn't actually put eyes on like the pictures of his son that this ghost had drawn. Like, he wasn't like really like looking. He was so reluctant, and so that was really frustrating. But also, again, you know, it's.
His role in this movie is so passive in so many different scenes. Like, at the your face on your face scene, he is just sitting there for so long before he intervenes. And, like, I don't know.
She had to do her monologue, Chelsea.
Yeah, well, she had to do her monologue. But it's so interesting to see, like, when he speaks up and, like, who he speaks up for and, like, what he's speaking up about, because so much of the time, he is just kind of sitting there letting things play out. And I'm sure it's because, like, he does not know what to do a lot of the time. And, like, maybe he thinks expressing themselves is better than bottling it up, even if the mom is saying some terrible shit to the son. But, yeah, he spends a lot of the movie kind of trying to corral everybody, but not really taking action on anything in a lot of ways. And it really comes to a head in that moment where he's like almost gonna do it, and he thinks that there is like, he thinks she's having another episode, basically. And he is like, we've seen this before, and I'm gonna call the police. There's more going on here. He thinks she's the one that, like, dug up her mom's grave and, like, dragged the body back into the house and put it in the attic. And he knows that she's been, like, lying to him, because now she's like, you remember I told you about Joan from the grief group, Joan, whose family died. And he's like, no, you never told me about any of this. You always just say you're going to the movies. Like, yeah, I mean, he has a lot of reason to not accept what she's saying. And
unfortunately he chooses to stand up at the exact wrong time. Not that it would have helped, honestly.
Yeah, I don't fully get, like, why he lights on fire when the notebook gets thrown in.
Because they don't like him.
Exactly. My theory is that he became the threat. Like, in the moment where Annie was going to throw the book in, she was a threat. She was a threat to this continuing on. Because Payman's around. He's floating around. He's a cute little teal light. He's doing his little teal light shit.
He's omnipresent.
Yeah, he's always there. And so in this moment, they're like, oh, fuck. Yeah, Toni Collette was the Annie. God damn it. I just like saying her name. It's so fun to say. She's the best. It's just Annie is a threat a little bit, too, because she knows what's going on. She knows there's some fucking crazy stuff going on. But this man has his phone out and he's about to call 911. And that will really mess stuff up.
Ruin everything.
We need grandma's body and they will take grandma's body away. Like, you know, like Peyman's like, I got to fuck this up now. And that was such a shock when he just fully, because she had put the paint thinner on the book. So he fully just blew up into flames. There was nothing she could do. That was such a shock.
That moment after that where she's like all horrified, but then you see the like lights going around the room and that like split second where her face changes. It is so well performed. It is seriously incredible to like, you know, like again, it's shit is fucked from here on out. Like there's no coming back because now you have fully seen her. She's possessed. And I mean, maybe that's part of it too. Like not just that he's the threat, but like now they have put her in such a vulnerable state that she is, I don't know, to reuse the word, she's vulnerable to Paimon's possession. Like she wasn't before, but now they've like absolutely broken her down and there's a host available for him now. Yeah.
It's just, her humanity just leaves her face in that moment. It's so, because she's so good at making that fucking face. She makes it several times.
I don't know if you guys ever watched United States of Tara, but it is such an amazing show. I was obsessed with it. I was obsessed with Toni Collette because of it. She is really good at doing that where like you see like something happen with her face and then she looks up and she's a completely different person. She is the master at that. She's the master.
I'm obsessed with her. And the rest of this movie is just so, so beyond. I love a thing that he does throughout the movie with the hidden people throughout. That's a common thing in horror movies. But I just love the way he does it in this scene where Peter
spooky grandma
wakes
in the
up.
Room. Spooky yeah, Charlie in the room.
Clear.
Those are great, but you know, again,
they're,
it's
and they're
like
very
baseline.
Overt. You can see them. But like Toni Collette, like Annie up in that corner, people missed her. People didn't see her at all. Because it's
that first
really
one,
subtle.
When he's in his
when
room.
And she's up in the corner.
No, like, before that even. There's that moment right before where he's in his room and he's like realizing something has happened before he goes downstairs. And you see for like 1 second in the very background, something white like crawling across the wall away. And it's so good. And I rewound like 15 times to be like, what am I looking at?
She's up in the corner before that. Did you miss that? That's what I'm talking about.
God. I tried to be like, is there something there?
No, go back and watch it.
She's like standing in the corner, like.
Yeah, that's why you didn't know what it was, because you hadn't seen her maybe up in the corner. Because when he wakes up, it's that same wide shot of the whole room, and you see very much in shadow her legs up in the corner, and because you're focusing on him. But she's up there. And then he finally gets up.
And you're like,
he's
looking
about,
at the lights in the treehouse out the window.
Yeah, he's about to, like, he hears something. And so he looks the other way. And then she floats by. I love that that's the reveal that she can fly. It was already clear there was some anti-gravity shit, but she can fly.
Well, she, again, with the bugs, she flies away like all the fucking flies in the house.
But yeah, it's just poor fucking Peter. Oh my God. What? Everybody is a victim in this movie, but like, oh my God, because apparently like you can hear like her, you hear the piano crash, you can hear the piano string being ripped out of the piano in this moment because it makes a specific sound. Didn't notice that. Love that detail. But he's like looking for mommy and daddy. He's calling out for mommy and daddy because he's just woken up from having a fucking terrible traumatic experience. Like they like sedated him after he smashed his face, his nose is broken, and you know you
apparently
have to come
he
downstairs.
Dislocated his jaw filming that scene. He wanted to really break his nose, is what it said on IMDb trivia. And Ari Aster was like, "No, we're not doing
that.
Don't do
but
that."
They had like a soft foamy top on the desk, and it was still hard underneath. And he smashed his face so hard into it that he'd previously dislocated his jaw, so his jaw was vulnerable to it. But he did it again.
That's so fucked.
Smashed it right out of place.
Oh, man. But yeah, that, like, slow reveal where he's, like, walking down, you see that the house is totally destroyed. And then he sees his dad's like blackened corpse on the ground.
The crackling of the fire still.
And the hand, like his dad's hand, like sticking up straight. And also, I don't think you can really tell this, but apparently the dad's corpse is also decapitated at that point.
Mm. Oh.
They don't show the head, and I thought they just didn't show it because it's horrifying. But what I was reading was that it's also decapitated, because that's Payman's thing. Also in his little picture where he's on a camel and he's got the staff with the hand. He's got a little satchel and it's got a bunch of decapitated heads. That's his thing. He loves a decapitated head.
Me too. Well, but I'm a guillotine type of bitch. So
yeah. I like to do it formally.
And Tony's up there flying.
She's up in the corner again. Yep.
And Nudie Man, this is where we see Nudie Man, who is the funeral man from before. So this is exciting.
Could you imagine, like, all this happening? You walk downstairs, you see your dad burnt to a crisp, and you turn around, and there's a naked man.
Honestly, that's
and then your mommy comes running, and then your mommy's up in the corner, but you don't see her, and then all of a sudden, boom, she's running at you.
Oh my god, another TikTok idea. This moment, and then it goes, run! Because that's exactly how it is. Like, all of a sudden, he's, like, confronted with this insane thing. His dad is scorched, and then his mom is tearing after him. And he goes upstairs, man!
Why do they always run upstairs?
And he goes into the attic! What's gonna happen in the attic, man? Like, what's gonna go on up there?
You're trapped.
He is trapped, but I also see the logic in being like, if I can pull the ladder up behind me, then she can't get to me. It's not a great strategy in, if you're really thinking about it and you're like, she maybe was going to light me on fire that other time. Seems like she lit my dad on fire. Now. There is a history of burning things down, and if I'm trapped in the attic, then I certainly could get burned down up in here. But like, don't worry, because that never happens, even though we also have this whole thing about like the space heaters on in the wooden treehouse and how that like is very much a fire hazard. Like, the fire hazards are like so not the point of the film, you guys.
Everywhere.
So. No. That's a side plot.
I want to know what they were doing up in that attic that it needs a lock like that on the inside of the attic.
Freaky cold shit.
Like,
freaky
did the cult?
Shit, maybe. Maybe
like, did
it's
the cult
like,
do that?
If they need to be up in the attic organizing things, they don't want Charlie to follow them up there. And so they're like, maybe that's like a safety thing while they're like up. I don't know. I'm inventing
things. Yeah, maybe
things.
They just didn't want anyone to be able to go up and see the body before it was time, you know? But I also just like little shouts out to decapitated Grandma Lee up there. I love this, the makeup on her body, the blackenedness of it. Blah, blah, blah. So messed up. But yeah,
was a good subtitles moment in this scene though, which Monica maybe didn't get to appreciate because she watched it without. But when you first here, some freaky shit is going down while Peter is up there, noticing that the body is gone, but the outline remains. And there's a picture with his eyes poked out. It says in the subtitles, flesh tearing and squelching, before it's revealed that Toni Collette is up there with, I don't know what weapons she has. She's making it work with whatever
it is. Wire.
It's
the
piano wire.
I was talking about earlier. Yeah.
What is she doing with it? I don't understand. Because to
she's
me,
sawing
I was
off
oh,
her head.
Oh, that is she so much him. Worse than what I thought was happening. Because yeah. I
sawing
to me,
her head
I was
off
like,
with the piano
she's
wire.
She's stabbing herself with two little chapsticks. But wow, wow, that
no,
is. I hate that.
She's pulling the piano wire through her throat. Oh
because
my god.
Peter jumps out the window, right? And when he does that, you hear her head hit the ground. Oof. And then
just
you see the little blue light around Peter. And so Peter is now Payman. But then you see his mommy, her headless corpse is flying into the treehouse. And he's like, I should follow that. That's where I need to go. Those are my people.
Yeah, I guess this part is also where you get part of the, like, was Charlie and Paimon the same thing? Because once he has been possessed, once the light has gone into him, he's Paimon now, he does the tongue click thing. And so it's like, okay, was it always Paimon doing that in Charlie? Was that a Charlie thing? But they're now intertwined, one in the same. And so now that Paimon is in Peter's body, it's bringing that like quirk of Charlie's. It's one of those moments where it's like you can't fully unentangle all of it.
I read somewhere the click is a cluck because Paimon is like related to birds. Like he's like represented in a lot of things by the bird
head.
And so is like a bird clucking, and Peter's nose after he breaks it looks beak like. And you see there's a bird in the cage, like right next to Charlie's head on a body, all that kind of stuff.
Dude.
Birds!
That's when you see the dog though too, because it's like he just like walks right by it and it's like outside, and you know, like even the dog got.
Yeah, can't have the dog around. It'll eat all the decapitated heads.
I hate movies that kill the dogs.
I know. I can't tell you how confused I was in that one scene where like he wakes up from something and the dog's the dog is Paimon. Like, I was so confused.
I don't know how demon.
I missed him. I noticed all these details. Like, I noticed the Heracles things this time around. I was like, I'm a genius, but I missed the dog. It was on a higher level. I was beyond dogs at this moment.
There's so much to take in. Like, I didn't notice that his mommy's head was decapitated when she was floating up into the treehouse, because I was just like, she's over there. She's all in white. That's spooky. She's floating. I don't need to look any closer.
Yeah, if you look at this image that I'll try to send to y'all right now, you can really see how Joan's house mimicked, like that scene in Joan's house mimicked this final scene that we end up getting, because it's just exact. There's the pigeon doll that is where that weird doll is that has literally Charlie's head on it. That was so disturbing, her old nasty head. And it has the like three decapitated mannequins that are bowing down to that thing. And so we have grandma's body is up there, you have mom's body's up there. I guess they didn't get dad's body up there. I didn't see three, but whatever. That was a beautiful little thing that I never noticed the significance of that before. But another thing that adds to how
they've got the tools Paimon, bowing.
But another thing that adds to like, oh, was Paimon always in there? Was he invited into the baby's body very young? Because Paimon obviously went inside of Peter. You saw the light go into him. But then Peter's up there and Joan's like, hey, Charlie.
Yeah.
You are Paimon. And so that kind of leads me to believe that they are one of the same, that they are fused, like maybe fused, because she has to explain to Charlie that they are Paimon. But like when that thing went back into Peter, like Charlie's spirit came with it, or like it was one and the same all along. I don't know, it's hard to say.
It makes sense to me though that it would be like a from birth thing potentially, and that like Charlie and Paimon are one and the same, in the sense that like she tried this with her 16-year-old son already. She knows that when you have someone who can fight back, someone who can be more aware of what's happening to them, that you're gonna have a much lower chance of success. Like, yes, do they eventually pull it off with a teenage boy in this series of events? Sure. But it took a lot more work than like one person being vulnerable to do it. That she would like learn from the experience with her son Charles, and have the baby from birth Charlie be payment makes a lot more sense, that she would be like, you have to have kids, like you have to, we have to start the process earlier, basically. And that's why she didn't target Peter in the first place, because he was already older by the time the grandma came back into their lives, and like he already wasn't as vulnerable. And to start the process in utero makes a lot more sense. Yeah. It makes a lot more sense why they would be like, Charlie, you're all right now. Like, they're speaking to Charlie at first in that scene, and then they're saying, you are Payman. So they're not like, Payman was in Charlie's body, now Payman is in Peter's body. They're like, Charlie is body. Yeah.
Oh, and it, just his expressions, another really good acting moment from him, like his expressions as like they all bow down to him. And oh, it's just such a haunting ending, and the pullback where it's like a miniature again.
The miniature! Oh. The way that it's like Toni Collette made this already, like she knew what was going to happen even if she didn't know what was going to happen. It's so interesting, especially after that scene where she smashed so many of her miniatures.
Yeah, I didn't even think about it that way. I was just thinking about it as an artistic choice. She smashed them all. Maybe she made it.
She took the Peter doll out of the car. She decapitated it and put it in bed. Like, there was fuck shit going on in that scene a lot already. So I am 100% willing to believe that she made this miniature in advance. Even before she was possessed in that scene, like there's enough fuck shit going on where I think it's very possible that she's having the episodes again without knowing it. We know she's having like these terrible dreams at the very least. So
yeah, and Peter could have been asleep for a long time after Daddy died, once Payman was already inside of Annie's body. So maybe she did it right then, real quick.
I want to know, what is Peter Payman cult people gonna tell the cops about mommy, burnt daddy, dead dog? Are the cops in the cult? Do they know? Like, is nobody gonna question this?
What's
like,
their end game after this?
They like, get fortune and fame and some shit.
But what is that?
Bring
fortune?
Us honor, wealth, and good familiars. That's very witchy.
Yeah.
They say they'll bind all men to our will, as we have bound ourselves for now and ever to yours, Hail Payman. So I guess maybe even if the police come and investigate, they can bind the police to their will. So it doesn't matter.
Honestly, maybe worth it. Mm-hmm.
They reject the Trinity and pray devoutly to great Payman.
Well, babes, I already said the magic words out loud, so I think we're well on
our
way.
Oh my god!
Yes,
a little
enter payment. Here we go.
Wow!
I love to be possessed.
I love it too.
I'm thrilled about it.
I think it's time for us to get into our segments, because this is a long episode, but we had to.
Ari Aster brings that out in us.
It's shorter than 4.5 hours of that one video.
Yeah, it is shorter than the video Sydney watched. Is it going to be maybe longer than the movie itself? Who can say? But it's probably going to be shorter than our Midsummer episode.
If we just move right in right now, maybe we can get in under 2 hours and 7 minutes. So how could this movie be gayer?
You know, I had absolutely no gay thoughts while watching this movie.
There was no time for joy.
There was no time for me to be like, gay! I was too busy being like,
I don't want any member of the LGBTQ plus family around this nonsense. Sure. This is straight people nonsense, okay?
Is this a first?
And I
do
feel that the way that Peter and his friends talk about their dicks is like straight boy shit. So,
oh yeah, so
yeah,
straight.
Yeah, there's no like wink to it. It's just like, haha, you have
They're
a dick,
just like,
I have
haha,
a dick,
your wax
friends.
And your D, haha, bring your dick to the party. Yeah.
Bro. Yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, I feel like there's something that could be said for Charlie if she was given the opportunity to grow up to not be a demon. And there's also something to be said about like the transness of Charlie.
Yeah, there's
the
interesting gender stuff.
Transness, like, because her grandma like told her like you were supposed to be a boy, and that obviously fucked with her. And she doesn't dress very gendered. She dresses rather androgynous and just in loose fitting hoodies. She looks comfy, honestly. I was jealous. Okay, yeah, but yeah, there's the transness and that and they really didn't get
it's
into it very much,
for sure.
But there
It is
something
interesting.
there for sure, because they make such a huge deal about Payman being in a male body, and then
He
if Charlie and
prefers
Payman
it.
are
Yeah.
the same,
Actually,
well,
that
something to
is
be said.
interesting because there's like some more thoughts on that in the page in that moment, and I took a like a picture of the screen, where it's hard to see it all, but there is stuff in that paragraph in the book that talks about him like maybe having a woman's face, but he uses strictly masculine pronouns. The sexes of the
Yeah,
host have
he
varied,
was.
but most of the successful incarnations have been with men. It's documented that King Payman has become livid and vengeful when offered a female host, which also maybe explains why shit got so fucked in this movie.
Yeah. But I think the description is like he prefers a male body,
He's
but
covetous.
has like very feminine attributes or things like that.
Oh,
I think
of a woman is what it says on the
yeah. But you could also
page.
Look at it like Charlie is pre-transition and Peter is post-transition. If you need to,
sure.
That is a look.
Yeah, there's a read.
Also, Millie
okay,
Shapiro is queer
already
in real life, so that's fun.
Yes.
Yeah, we
yes.
love that.
Millie is so cool.
She's cool. She's like alt.
Follow her on Instagram. Her fashion is so cool. I love her makeup looks too. But anyway, okay, that's our gay thoughts. Moving on to where would Matthew Lillard fit into this movie? Cult member.
Yeah.
Matthew
right
Lillard would have been the history teacher.
I could see him in that. I could also see him as, oh, is this inappropriate to say?
The naked
creepy
smiling man.
Smiley man that turns into naked man later on. I could just see him doing a real creepy smile. I'm not trying to be pervy, okay? I'm just saying. He would be great just to be like,
we would
smile.
Have looked respectfully.
Also, I didn't realize that was the same guy until I read about it. So no one would
have
had to know.
His nudity is very distracting.
Yes. Couldn't
I just noticed
face,
that
there
he was blonde. And you know how I feel about blonde men.
Another blonde man. Yeah.
Terrifying.
Evil.
Okay, I think that's good. Miscellaneous cult member or history teacher or smiley man. But cult member, definitely. Something small
for sure.
So we're not distracted.
Yeah.
Okay, that brings us to the dumb pitch. That's hard. It's hard for this one because they're all like we're saying that there's nothing they could do. They were locked into this game from birth, all of them. Even
if
Annie.
You
not
are
Steve.
Not.
I think
team.
Grandma.
Yeah, if you're not team cult, I think Queen Lee is the dumb
yeah.
bitch because she sets everything in motion. If you
but
are team
so
cult, then she's very on top of her game. Yeah.
I feel like she's not dumb bitch, though, because she's just evil bitch. She's just evil. You know what I mean? Like, she's smart. This is a good plan.
Yeah, but here's
it
the thing.
It was a really good plan. She just happened to die, so that
summoning
was bad. Summoning
a demon is always a dumb idea.
Unless they give you fame and fortune,
for
Sydney.
They're going to have fame,
have
fortune,
even
control
considered
the will of men, cool familiars, whatever that
I
means.
I would,
they get
like,
a Guillermo of their choice.
Oh, my God, I would love a Guillermo.
Yeah. So it sounds like a sick deal. I'm not going to do it, even though I might have.
We've already started
with
it, Monica.
Earlier.
Actually,
I'm
I think
so
Monica
upset.
Is
Monica,
the dumb
Monica's
bitch.
The dumb bitch.
Starting
I'm the dumb bitch
us
I said
on
the
this
fucking
journey.
Out loud.
Actually,
where's
I'm willing
Ed?
To support that.
We have this friend, Ed, who is religious, and he watched The Witch with me. That was a fun experience. He also watched us do a witch night, me and Sydney, and afterwards prayed for us.
Yep.
And I really wish he was here now to pray for me, just in case, just to help.
Just shoot him a text.
Hey, Ed, could you just
Eddie.
Do a little, like, voice
just
note
one,
of
like,
hell?
Prayer, please.
Because I might have just summoned a demon.
Oh, I've
yeah,
started
Monica's
the process.
Bitch.
Monica's
for
the
sure
dumb bitch.
Monica.
I'm the dumb bitch. I accept that.
Chelsea perfect, Monica dumb bitch.
I'm the dumb bitch.
Perfect.
Only,
yeah.
Only in this episode, though. Going forward, it's not going to be
we'll
me.
We'll wipe
this
like clean for you next
twice.
Episode. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Okay, that brings us to our knives out of fives. So, Chelsea, set the scene.
This movie was very recently dethroned as A24's highest grossing film. Like, this was A24's most successful film up until Talk to Me came out recently. But it is, like, very well regarded from critics and stuff like that. There's, like, it was nominated and won, like, a zillion different random awards, if you want to check it out on IMDb. But it does have a 7.3 out of 10 on IMDb, which seems a little low, if you ask me. But it has 90% fresh from critics on Rotten Tomatoes. And it has 70% fresh from audiences.
I can see how there could be naysayers because they're like, I'm so mad at you that you did this to me. I'll never be the same. Help me, the pain, the agony. But they're wrong. Like, it really, still beautiful art.
It really benefits from a second viewing. And so I think if you only watch the movie once, you're going to rate it a lot worse. Because, like, when I had only seen this movie once, I was like, I don't really get it. Like, yes, everyone's performances were good, but, like, okay. And I kind of just, like, moved on with my life for the most part. But when you watch it a second time, you can really appreciate what you're watching. So I can see the numbers not necessarily being, like, representative of the work that was put into this film or the story that this film told. Because it's really hard to appreciate when you don't know what you're appreciating yet. But it did get Alex Wolff a 2019 MTV Movie Award nomination for Most Frightened Performance. So they did get their flowers in that sense.
Amazing. Okay, well, I'll just go first. And I'm going to be short and sweet because we're over 2 hours. 5 out of 5. This, I think, is a genius movie. I think it's brilliant. It's really true to life with a lot of the things that happen when you're grieving. On the realism level, and then it goes supernatural and it gets fucking just insane, and I love all the details. It's beautifully shot. The sound design is fucking terrifying. 5 out of 5.
Yeah, there's some incredible shots in this film. There's some amazing transitions. The miniature work is like no fucking other. It is incredible. It is so gorgeous. It is so stunning. The way it's utilized in the film is so amazing. I'm obsessed with miniatures. We, somebody told me earlier today about a miniature museum that they used to go to in LA, and I was so jealous. And then I Googled it and I found out it closed in the year 2000. And I was so sad. I know. I was like, could I go tomorrow? I'll go tomorrow. But I have to travel through time to do that. But yeah, I mean, the technical mastery in this film, both in regards to the directing, the cinematography, the production design, the acting, like, it is very much deserving of 5 knives out of 5s in that regard. Like, again, I still kind of feel like there's a lot I don't get. There's probably a lot that's going over my head. But aside from that, my respect for the filmmaking process is so high that, like, I wouldn't give it anything else.
You know how I feel about elevated highbrow horror. But this movie is just so good. Like, I don't even give a shit about that. Like,
it's just good.
It's just so good. And the more you watch it, because I watched it 3 times now, the more you keep noticing and the more you keep seeing. And then the third time I watched it after watching that 4.5 hour video, so I saw even more things. And it's really good. It's really fun. I'm so glad we did it after, like, never finding the right time. I think this is such a good time to do it. 5 out of 5.
5 out of 5.
Okay, so that is Hereditary. I think that was incredible, fun. Do I know anything? No. Do I know more than the last time I watched it? Yes, absolutely.
It's so important to learn.
I love learning. Fuck shit.
Educational.
Honestly, this movie is educational. It teaches you how to pay attention and how to focus.
Look for the signs. Your family might be in a demon cult.
Right?
Look for the signs.
How do you know if your family's in a demon cult unless you pay attention? Mm-hmm. Could never be me. Could never be me. I don't want to know.
Yeah, it wouldn't be me.
But next week, we're continuing on with that trend of paying attention, right?
We're going with this.
Well, honestly, our next movie that we're doing next week, the trend is paying attention and also being a nosy neighbor. And that is 1985's Fright Night.
I'm so glad we're doing this movie. Oh my God. I watched this sometime in the last 2 years and was truly blown away. Just truly.
Yeah, I don't know much about it other than Colin Farrell is in the remake because we're doing the original, but I'm curious to find out what the deal is.
Yeah, see, I don't know anything about the remake, except I just found out that David Tennant is in it, and I only knew about the Anton Yelchin of it all. May he rest in peace. I will watch R.I.P. I'll watch the remake just for him and Colin Farrell and also David Tennant. But
so I think we need to watch the remake.
We gotta do the remake.
It can't hold a torch. Or what is that? No. You can hold the candle? Torch for the original. It can't hold a candle. There we go. Smaller flame.
Something that's on fire.
To the original, because the original's got that 80s, mwah, you know,
that,
you know,
has that pizzazz,
that little, yeah, the eight, yeah, the 80s riz,
the 80s swag.
80s riz.
I can't wait. You're in for a treat, Chelsea.
Okay,
all right, I'm so excited for next week, but we got to decide our poll question. What should it be? Should it be fucked up? Should it be super fucked up? Which part of the movie made you feel like you were gonna die most?
I think this movie, honestly, the dog dying hurt me the most.
Okay, so like
we could put that in
the pole scene, the dog, the dad bursting into flames.
Oh, Daddy Toni Collette,
her whale.
Toni Collette sawing her head off midair.
I'll put them in like
vague terms too, just in case someone stumbles across and I don't want to spoil them right away. But I'll put them in vague terms. So which part of the movie made you feel the most die-y?
Yeah,
there you go.
Which was the most fuck shit in your opinion?
Yeah, on a scale of fuck shit to the most fuck shit, which is your favorite? Okay, cool. Well, you know, we've just gone through a trial and a tribulation. I'm disturbed. What would make me feel better? A 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify. Also, why not follow us on social media? We are at Spooky. Oh my God, I can't speak. At Spooky _ Tuesday on TikTok, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We're also at Spooky Tuesday Pod on Facebook and Tumblr. And we're at Spooky Tuesday on Letterboxd. And as I say, every week. Thank you for listening and see you next Tuesday.
Bye, spookies.
Spooky Tuesday was created by Monica Height, Sydney Thompson, and Chelsea Duff, and edited by Sydney Thompson. Our gorgeously spooky tunes are all thanks to Tamra Simons, who you can follow on Instagram at Captain Tamra, and our podcast art is by Mary Murphy, who you can find on Instagram at the_moon_OMG.